few years back a couple of times. And I told Rich, when he asked me, I says, "There'll be a cold day in hell till I speak down there again. It takes something like a blizzard to get me down, and here we are." But I am, I even text him to see if he still have it, because in the time I'm blessed in these rooms, I had gone, I was talking to a friend earlier, and before the meeting, and text him to see if we were still having one, because one time I did go to a meeting, and it was in Emmaus, and in weather like this, and there was nobody there, and the church was closed and that. And I also had that experience in South Carolina when I was on vacation. And I went to a meeting, called and got a directions to go to a meeting. And I went there, and the church was locked up, and the meeting was extinct. But a newcomer showed up, and him and I had our own meeting for about a half an hour, 40 minutes. And I know it helped me. I believe it helped him. But anyway, there are three drunks sitting in a bar, and they're discussing what's the fastest thing on this here planet. And the first drunk says, "Well, it's the light. You turn, you hit the switch, it's electricity. The lights come right on." Second drunk says, "No, it's not that. It's your eyes. When you blink, that's the fastest thing." And the third drunk says, "No, it's a thought, because as soon as a thought comes, there it is. You know, there it is. And if you ever tried meditation, there it is." And they couldn't decide which one was right. And so after a couple of more drinks, they turned around to Joe the wino. They say, "Hey, Joe, what's the fastest thing here on earth?" And Joe the wino says, "Diarrhea." And he says, "Diarrhea?" He said, "Yeah, before I had time to think, blink, or turn the lights on, there it was." You want to talk, John?
I just put it in.
Oh. And if you're laughing, and one thing I've got from the people that came before me is that I don't take myself serious, but I take my sobriety serious. And if you're laughing, I believe wholeheartedly that you're getting a reprieve for that moment from the most insidious thing that we face as alcoholics, and that's our mind and our thinking. Because when I'm laughing, I'm not thinking. And I'm enjoying life, and I'm enjoying the moment, and I'm in that moment. I was born up in Emmaus, a middle-class family. Mom, she drank once, twice a year, had a highball. My dad, he drank daily. And I remember going to a local tavern down the street. And as a kid growing up, he'd get clams down there. We'd go down there maybe once, twice a month. And he'd always get clams with the melted butter. And I says, "Hey, Pop," I remember asking, I said, "Hey, Pop, why do you drink the melted butter all the time after you eat the clams, you know?" And he says, "Oh, it coats your stomach. You know, he could drink more then." I thought, cool. And I took that to heart. And as I grew up and I started drinking, I did that on several occasions. I also did the one eye, you know, driving home. And he also taught me that, especially like in the wintertime when you're drinking, put your elbow out the window, because the cold air will hit the nerve endings and it'll keep you awake. And I thought, well, that's, you know, this is all good stuff to take home to the bank, you know. But I could assure you, don't do the butter thing, because I stand before you with a cholesterol problem now and I take medication. But anyway, growing up and going to school, and there I had a, you know, I'll get out of the way now. I'm an addict also, and I have to give cocaine an honorable mention, and I believe that brought me in here faster, and enough that I ate my septum out. And if that's all that happened to me, I'm grateful. And that's all the repercussions of that good stuff that I have today. But growing up, I had gone to high school, and I graduated high school, and I was very backwards, I was a very fearful, insecure kid. And I remember down at the park, I live across from the park, and the neighborhood kids, we'd be down there playing wiffle ball or kickball, kick the cans and stuff, and that was all great, wonderful, and terrific. But as soon as somebody brought a bat and a ball out, or as soon as somebody brought the glove out or a football, Ed lied back then already, 10, 12, 14 years old. And I said I had to go home. I had chores to do. I had to eat. And I didn't have to do any of that. It was out of my fear and insecurity, because I was too afraid of what you were going to say when I struck out. I was too afraid of what you were going to say when I missed the ball. And as a result of that fear and insecurity, I never played sports in school, and I never even dated in that. I'm very backwards. And I had landscaping at Votech for 3 years, and I enjoyed putzing around outside in the summertime. You come by the house and the pool, and there's the gardens there, and I find serenity in there. I find a part of the God of my understanding in there. And I know for myself that I came to believe that because I putz around the house that and the yard, that I'm a pretty good putz, you know. And I enjoy it. And so I know for myself that, you know, I had these 3 years of Votech, and I also bartended 15 years. I was a bartender for 15 years. I made good money, the money in my pocket was what I thought life was about. I remember in high school I had gotten a black Cordoba with that rich Corinthian leather, maroon, you know. What was it? Ricardo Montalban. That's who it was, yeah. And I thought I was cool. Because, see, that money in my pocket was better than fearful, insecure Ed. That Cordoba was better than fearful, insecure Ed. And I was something. I had to be something because I was nothing in my own thinking. And so as time went on, and I had bartended three places, and I thought, well, now maybe it's time. In between those places, and I bring up the landscaping because I thought now it's time to maybe I should go back into that landscaping and do something. And with the monies that I was making, that I had, I bought about $2,500, $3,500 worth of equipment, you know, a trailer, a 42-inch riding mower, and a boom sprayer and everything, you know, and weed eaters and... I never did a job. It rusted in the backyard. I think I promised a guy one time I'll come out and give him an estimate, and I never even showed up for that. And I know for myself that it's like, you know, I gave the stuff to my aunt then, you know, because it rusted. She got 80-some acres. Maybe she could use it. So I went back into the bartending business because my thinking was that I'm going to bartend at night and I'm going to do landscaping during the day. And it didn't work out that way because the drinking and the party goods took precedent. And that became my responsibility. And so I know at times that when I was bartending and that fearful, insecure Ed, that I knew that when people would come in, and I knew this one guy that he'd come in with his little entourage of guys and girls, friends, that, you know, he would start to get on me, and I was like the duck going back and forth in a carnival, you know, the arcade. This is how I was behind the bar. But I felt safe and secure there. because I had the power. I could cut you off. You're going to respect me. You know, you're going to do what I say. You know? And I know for myself that as time went on, that this guy would come in and he would take his pop shots at me verbally. So in my head, my thinking again is that when he came in and I saw him, I had to get the people around the bar and his friends to laugh at him first before they get them to laugh at me. Because if I did that, I won. And out of that fear and insecurity, I won. But it didn't really matter because I lost every job that I had from booze and from the party goods. And so as time went on, I went and my pop had passed away at the age of 55. And this disease does kill, and that's why I take my sobriety serious. And I believe that everyone has their own spot, their own line, where I believe that God doesn't allow any more pain. And some of us are blessed to come into these rooms, and others aren't. And I know for myself, because of my pop that he drank daily, that and when we come into these rooms that we don't drink anymore, hopefully. And I know for myself that my father, at the age of 55, was in a hospital for 4 days. And he had 13 transfusions in those 4 days of blood. Because as fast as they were pumping it in, that's as fast as his stomach was bleeding out in other orifices. But I could tell you, my father, Joseph Trushin, doesn't drink anymore. And even with that, I didn't myself take that as any sign to come into rooms or maybe I have a problem. I was blessed with one DUI. I should have had 101 with the times I drove in blackouts and not knowing how I got home. And checking the money on a dresser at the next day or looking out the window to see if the truck's there. And then I'd have to look and try to backplay to see where I was and what happened. And another thing that happened in while I was drinking and blacking out, I used to tell people what I really thought of them. Now, that's not too good. And I used to hate apologizing to people for things I didn't remember saying or doing. And then I would think about it, and then I would drink to try to forget about it, that I did this, and then I would do it again, and maybe to that same person or somebody else. And so while I'm drinking to forget that I did this, I'm doing it again, and then I had to apologize again. And that was a vicious cycle. And there again, my thinking. And so I know for myself that what I like to call and refer to my spiritual intervention was I was in a basement, fired from yet another job. And I didn't know. And the same time I was running one, I was bartending at one club. I have to say this. I was managing another and running another club. And they had poker machines there. And as I started to spend money that I wasn't making yet, and as I started to drain my checking and savings, there again, my thoughts, my thinking was, well, you know, I'm the only one that knows how much money's coming in this joint, along with the vendor. So I did a little thing that you could go to jail for. It's called embezzlement. And I kept two sets of books in case any of the other officers would ask me where the receipts and the money's in that. I did that, and I kept two sets of books. And there was another thing that I used to do because of being fearful and insecure that I remember that when I was behind the bar, the attention was all on me. And boy, that helps a drunk like myself with a pride and ego like I have. And people used to say, oh, you're a bartender's bartender. They said, we're coming in here to see you because we like you, you know. We don't like that barmaid and this and that, you know. And that's all you got to do to drunk with over my pride and ego. And so... and so what I would do is I kept a black book in my back pocket and I kept a pen. And I had all the numbers for the other club that I was running there, the bowling mechanic, the bands that were there, the Banco Beverage, A-Treat Beverage when they were in business. Now they're closed. Bartenders, waitresses. So if there was a problem at this other club I was running and I was bartending at this club, I would answer the phone, I'd pull the black book out of my pocket and I would look up the number and make another call. Well, it got back to the officer of the club who approached me and said, Ed, we think you're booking sports and running book. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. That's better than fearful, insecure Ed. So as time went on, and my thinking was is that when the phone would ring now, I'd go through the motions, pull the black book out, put the pen, and I'd write scribbly lines. And then my thinking was, well, geez, if you black out, you leave this book lane, you lose it, you know, somebody's going to know that you're fake, you're a fraud. So I started to write down, you know, Mets 4, Dodgers 7. I didn't even know if they were in the same league or not, but I was my thinking. And then I would think that, well, geez, you know, this is going pretty good. I'm going to branch out a little bit. So I started to write in there like, for horse racing, Black Mooney in the 7th. Whatever, I don't know. I didn't even know if they were running that day. And I must have done it pretty good because a gentleman came to me one time and he says, hey, you know there's a Super Bowl. I said, yeah. He said, well, it's coming up this Sunday. I said, yeah. He said, well, how about? I said, what are you talking about? He said, you know, a little action. Hey, I don't know. And a lot of times with my life, with people and relationships, it was like, come on, stop. Come on, stop. And not letting anyone in. Because I didn't want to, I may look good on the outside, but if I tell you what's going on with me and what I'm thinking and feeling, you're not really going to know me. And then how are you going to like me? Because I'm being open and honest with you, so I'm going to keep the facade going. And because you like the outside. And so I know for myself, the phone would ring, I'd pick up the phone, I'd go through all these motions and this and that, and people are all looking at me, and I'm feeling great, wonderful, and terrific. And I never took a bet in my life. But yet they didn't know that. And I wouldn't be honest with them because I was too afraid of finding out who I was, but more importantly, who I wasn't. And so as time went by and I got fired from that job and I wound up, well, like I say, I started to say my spiritual intervention. I wound up in the basement of my house. I was living with there with mom because Pop passed away. And, you know, and I would give my check home at times. And otherwise, other times she said, keep it. And I paid rent and stuff and do things around the house. And I have a finished basement. And I was an organized drunk. And I thought, well, because I work in a bar, I had to have the muddlers and the copper cups for the Moscow mules. I don't know if they make them anymore. But I had all, and on the shelves behind the bar was, you know, your top shelf has to be top shelf. So there's all the scotches and everything. And then the bourbons and the Windsors on the bottom, you know. And over here was wines and schnapps there. And the Zambuca and the Baileys in the fridge. And And I used to go shopping at times, and I'd go, I have a big liquor cabinet that I was made in plywood. And I would go, and I would go shopping, like, oh, this is getting low behind the bar. And then I'd go look in the cabinet there, and I'd be writing down like you go grocery shopping. And I remember the one time that this gentleman, I was standing in line with a cart full of booze and a shopping cart, because they have those nice little ones. And I remember a time standing there, and this gentleman in front of me had the audacity to belittle me. And he turned around, and what he said belittled me, a drunk of my pride and ego. He says, what bar is that for? And I says, what are you talking about? This is for my house. It wound up to be about $250 worth of booze, you know. How dare he ask what bar? So with that, I went out and I got over that one. I think I had a drink to get over that one. It was within arm's reach. But anyway, trying to get back to my spiritual intervention. I remember I was in that basement and wasn't using glasses anymore, drinking out of the bottles, and I was doing the party goods off the bar. And I remember at times that Mom would come down and she'd say, what's the matter, Ed? What's the matter? And I would stay straight looking at the TV. And I wouldn't even acknowledge my mother was 10 feet away from me. And she'd get frustrated and go back upstairs. And I do have to tell you that my uncle, who's now passed, used to call every day, what's new? Sometimes 2-3 times a day. And I used to say to him like 2 hours later, what could be new in 2 hours? You know, so there were times, and when he would call, he would never leave a message. And then finally, he left a message, and the message was, now what the hell is going on out there? Because you see, the condition in my thinking is that, and I would not let my mother pick up the phone in her own house for 3 days. And that's how drawn away and separated I wanted to be and isolated from society. And that's how much I didn't want to be a part of society, nor want you to be a part of me. And the last 5-7 years of my drinking or so, friends, family, co-workers used to say, Ed, you're drunk. Ed, you need AA. Ed, you should get help. Mind your own business. Go do something else. Leave me alone. And my spiritual intervention was when I was down, and I could remember it as it was yesterday. And I hear in these rooms that people say, well, God doesn't talk to you, but he does talk through other people. And I disagree. I do believe he talks through other people. But I also believe he talks to me. And it's called a thought. And the reason I believe that is because I was drinking, and I could remember this thought as clear as day. It was a few years back when I called the rehab. And I could tell you where I was facing in that basement. I could tell you with the booze and the cocaine there. And I could tell you that thought. And the thought was, isn't this great, Ed? You have everything you want in life. You drained your checking, your savings, you're unemployed, unemployable. Isn't this great? And see, nobody was around. And that thought, because I was in that basement alone. And for me, that was the epiphany that I picked up the phone and I called the rehab. And then they said about coming up, they'll say, and that was the first time I was honest with somebody with how much I was drinking and partying. And they said, well, you certainly qualify. We'll send a vehicle for you tonight. And I said, no, no. I said, I'm running a business, which was that other club. And I had put people in place, and I agreed to go on Thursday. And I got it right up to that rehab on Thursday, and I went in there. And I can't tell you, like I say, that date. I could tell you who was there, was myself in that basement, the thought. But I can't tell you the date. But I could tell you my sobriety date. And I had these thoughts and these situations through the time I'm blessed in my sobriety. And because I can't tell you the date, but the non-coincidences that happen, that bring something, there's a time in my sobriety that I found out with, I had a lump on my testicle and I had a cancer scare and I found out that I couldn't have kids in sobriety. And I was crying and I was raking the leaves. It was towards the fall or raking the sticks. And I was right there at the front tree on the right side. And a girl that I knew had 9 years at that time. And she came driving by. And she stopped. And she didn't know where I lived. I said, "What are you doing here?" She said, "I was just out driving. I saw you in the yard." And she saw the tears in my eyes. And she says, "You want to talk?" I said, "Sure." And we went into my house in the dining room. And I told her what was up. I was open and honest. And she said, "I know exactly how you feel, because I can't have kids either." These things had happened to me, and I could tell you who it is. I could tell you. And unfortunately, she went back out, and she moved to Philly or Jersey, and I heard a couple of times from her. She was drunk, leaving a message. And until now, I don't believe she ever got a year again. But it was a non-coincidence in my life, in my sobriety, that she was there for me. I can't plan that. Is it odd or is it God? I get to choose. I know what I believe. Can't tell you the date, but I could tell you the sobriety date. And so I believe that these things that happened to me in sobriety and the non-coincidences, as they call and they say, that's a non-coincidence, no such thing as a coincidence, that's God's way of staying anonymous. And I just told him, I said, "You're showing off again, God." That's how I like to talk to him. Because I know the God of my understanding, he's a thrifty son of a gun. Because he uses one person to get double results. It's like one drunk talking to another. One drunk helping go through the steps. And they both get help. He's thrifty, that son of a gun. And I love it. So anyway, I went to rehab. I came back home. And the same thing with the gentleman that took me to the rehab. He said, "I'll go to your first meeting." And so did the a gentleman that I had to get a contact person. "I'll go to your first meeting with you." And I came home on a Wednesday and I couldn't hit a meeting. I mean, I could hit a meeting, but neither of those two gentlemen could make it. And I had the willingness to go to a meeting on my own. Because I believe I had to. And there's a saying in these rooms also, and I don't know, maybe I'm just a rabble-rouser, I don't know. But I heard in these rooms in the beginning, and I bought into this saying that it's not for those who need it, it's for those who want it. And I bought into that. I bought into that for a few years. But as I started to see people come and go, and as I started to be blessed with sponsorship, and I saw sponsees come and go, I firmly believe that it's not for those who want it, it's for those who work it, who work this program. And I could assure you that you don't have to drink over anything. And not quite 2 years of sobriety, my mother passed away. 3 months later, my aunt passed away. About another month, 4 months after Mom, my sponsor moved away. I remember thinking and feeling, these are the two most important people in my life have deserted me. My cousin passed away. I had that cancer scare. I couldn't get a mortgage to the house to pay my brother and sister off because banks looked at something, which I never knew, debt to income. What do I know about that? I knew I was in debt because I had a bar tab to pay. You know, I'll pay that when I get paid. You know, you start talking about some large amounts of money, then they look at you. And there was another non-coincidence that happened when I finally got the mortgage. And my uncle used to say to me, boy, God only gives you as much as you could handle. I said, boy, it must be a big party plate that I have. He only puts as much on that plate. And I didn't agree with him either. But I do believe that the God of my understanding, that as long as I reach out to him, he will help me through it. Because that's not from God. I was brought up with that punishing God in church. Parents would die from people taken for so-called acts of God. You know, and I heard the one time that also, there's a woman that was a Sunday school teacher, and she sang in a choir, and she stepped out into the street, and an 18-wheeler came by and didn't see her and killed her. And I hear people say, oh, I guess God wanted a choir member, another choir member. Oh, so he takes you and kills you with an 18-wheeler. That might be your God. The God of your understanding certainly isn't of mine. And I had to work through these thoughts and these things that, you know, just like they say with a trash can, you know, that we come in full of trash and we have to empty it out. I remember talking to my sponsor, and I says, Glenn. He said, Ed, let's look at this as far as like with the steps and with the fourth step and that. And he says, let's look at this and your qualities and talk with the fifth step. And he says, you have down a good worker. I says, well, yeah, I went to work. He says, well, what about calling out sick? And I said, yeah, I did that. He said, I thought you told me that you went in there and you used to fake at the bar. You used to fake like your side hurt or this and that and so you could get out of work. I says, yeah. Then I'd go to another bar. You know, an officer would take over and he may say, it's a small town. Boy, did I get called on the carpet for that. He said, what about the times you went into work late? I said, okay, so. I said, so in other words, you're trying to tell me I was a good worker except for showing up late, calling out, not really doing my job there. And so you have to, you know, this is the distorted thinking that I had. And I came to believe that it's a disease of perception as well as mental, physical, and spiritual, and a disease of the attitudes. But I needed somebody to help guide me through me and my thinking. And I certainly came to believe, because at the time I'm blessed in these rooms, I certainly don't have that thought of the drink or the party goods anymore. But my thinking could still get me in trouble. And so I came to believe that it's simply how I think. It's S-H-I-T, it's shit, it's simply how I think. And I got to bounce that off somebody, because I could think I have a good idea. And I remember walking with my sponsor, and I'm sharing something with him, and I'm going to do this, that, and he like just looks at me like, well, maybe you want to try it this way, Ed. You know, and I remember I was told that the recovery is that pause that we get in between the mind thinking something and us following up and following it with action, or the mind thinking and the tongue spitting it out. And it's that pause, that little nanosecond that's in there, that we don't. And I know for myself, you know, I used to be a jukebox. You know, you put a quarter in me, you press B5, B5 plays. You want to dance? We'll dance. Today, because it was always thought, action, thought, action, thought, action. Today, you put a quarter in me, you could press B5. I get to choose whether I play B5 or not with that gift of pause. And because of that, I don't create as much chaos anymore in my life. And so I know I remember saying to Glenn, he says, how you doing, Ed? I says, oh, I'm doing okay. I'm I'm hanging in. He says, well, keep, we're hanging on. I'm hanging on. He says, keep hanging on, hanging on. I says, Glenn, how do you hang on? He said, let go, let go. You know, I thought I was dealing with the Zen master. I didn't know I had to let go of all these things. But that helped me with the first step, with the powerlessness and the unmanageability. And the unmanageability in my life wasn't the DUI. The unmanageability for me wasn't that draining of the checking and savings and not having money. The unmanageability for me was I crossed that line and I, from a problem drinker and I could no longer, to an alcoholic, and I could no longer go back to that social drinking. Because I'd say I'd go out for a couple and I'd be out till the next day. The DUI, the fender benders and all that came because of my drinking. That was the unmanageability. The loss of the jobs wasn't the unmanageability, it was my drinking. I couldn't control my drinking. And since I couldn't control my drinking and I would show up and be drunk, or because I wouldn't show up at all, or I didn't get stuff done because of my drinking, I lost a job. Then step two, I came to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. And that was you people when I first came in. They said, Ed, don't talk. Because they're again a drunk of my pride and ego. I'd come from rehab. I was church council president. I was club president. I'm going to be AA's president. You're president. You know, and they said, Ed, don't talk. And he says, if we want to know how to embezzle from a club, we'll call on you. If we want to know how to gyp someone out of a drug deal, we'll call on you. We want to know how to go through a couple of bartender shifts, we'll call on it. Otherwise, you don't know nothing about sobriety. And so I sat and I listened. And in step two, I came and I did take a piecemeal. I said, I came. I kept coming to these rooms. Then I came too because the fog started to lift. And I was able to actually start thinking. Well, let's not think. I was able to start listening. Because my thinking was there. I remember at times, I don't know how many months, first 5-6 months or better, I'm sitting in the meetings and I'm wondering, how am I going to pay this next bill? I'm wondering, geez, I wonder if that person likes me. I'm looking at, boy, is that person that, I won't say what I was thinking. And I was wondering, I wonder if anyone's missed me at the club. Wonder if they're singing Sinatra. They better not. That was my gig. And as I'm thinking, and in my own head, 3 or 4 people are sharing, I didn't hear a word they said. This is a process, a spiritual journey. And today I'm able just to be sober. I'm able to sit there and I take a coffee mug with me and I sit and I look focused at that. There's angels on there. And that staying focused on there helps keep me in the moment. Because I'm looking up. I remember one time, I don't know, I might have had 2-3 years. And I'm looking at a guy called Lefty. And at that time, he had long black hair. I was at a men's meeting. I'm sitting right behind him. I'm looking. And this is at 2-3 years. And I'm thinking, again, my thinking, boy, I wonder, that's pretty cool hair he has. I wonder how I'd look with long hair instead of short all the time. And 2 or 3 people had shared, I didn't hear a word they said. But I could tell you that this process, when that had happened, again, I was blessed with the thought, Ed, get focused. Lord, help me to stay focused. Because as the literature says, I am powerless, I have no power. There's one who has all power, I have to tap into that power. So I came too because the fog started to lift and I was able to stay focused in a moment, and I came to believe because of you people going through not only deaths and losses of jobs and houses and everything, but the guy outside didn't say hi to you. I didn't have to get all bent out of shape over that. And I saw that. And so I know for myself that, you know, as time went on in this process, and I'm blessed to see these things, And I believe that's what spirituality is. It's awakening. I was spiritually dead before. I wasn't awakened. These steps in the God of my understanding and you people and ones that came before me had helped me to awaken. And I believe spirituality, as it says in the sixth or seventh step in the 12 and 12, it says that spirituality is seeing who we are and what we are and having a willingness to be who we can become with the help of God. See, I could see when I'm doing something wrong. I could see when I'm thinking something wrong. Am I willing to do something about it? Am I willing to do that 10-step spot check inventory right away? And because I did that and we had that tool in the rehab, I brought that tool home. We did a 10-step. Because I was told that you need two things, an attitude of gratitude, and the same person's going to drink again, so you have to change. And I brought the 10-step home with me from the rehab, and I shared with sponsors, do that 10-step right away. Well, what if somebody says that because the steps are in order? Well, tell them you're doing a mini 10-step. I say, because it's time to start looking at your side of the street and your behaviors and your actions instead of pointing the finger at everybody else. And at night when you say your prayers and you do the 10th and 11th step, that you're seeking God and you're seeking your higher power in the beginning. And in prayer, you're thanking Him. That's the attitude of gratitude. Thank you for another day sober. Thank you for a roof over my head. Thank you for the food that's provided. Whatever you're grateful for. And go in and start doing, look, go back and look. And don't look back over your day so anally, like I woke up at 8 and from 8 to 8.07 I was this. And, you know, keep it simple. As much as you could see, here I got angry. Thank you, God, for allowing me to see my anger. Help me to be willing to work through it. I was taught and told that make friends with your internal enemies. Because as long as I make friends, what is it about some of us that we come in these rooms and we have to change because the same person's going to drink again. And when we see one of our character defects, number one, first of all, we don't want to see it. And number two, we don't want to own it. And then we're afraid of it instead of embracing it. I believe in this process, in this spiritual process, it's a process of coming home. It's a process of who I should have always been. Or who God wants me to be. And I know for myself that the more I see of myself and that spirituality of seeing and awakening of who I could be. And just to be. Just to be sober, I'm able to go to work today. Just to be sober, I'm able to come here. Just to be sober, I'm able to be a good neighbor, a good brother, a good friend. Just to be. And I think at times we have to take, elevate that spirituality, I know for me, inside myself. And to remember that of myself, I am nothing, and the Father doeth the work. And I know that there's times where I had even gotten a little stagnant. And I do want to share this. I'm sorry, I see I'm going, it's almost 5-0 already. But I do want to say something that is vitally important that for me and my sobriety, that going through the steps and seeing who I was and who I could possibly become in the 5th step and the 6th and the 7th steps and having that humility to come into place and the 8th step and the 9th. I didn't get the freedom that some people get with the 5th step. My freedom came from the 9th step with the amends. When my sponsor told me go in and lay down for an hour and review the first 5 proposals, I fell asleep in about 20 minutes. I just rehashed my whole life. I didn't feel any joy and elation in it. I fell asleep. I was drained. But with the 9th step, I started to feel that lightness. And I think I hear people in the room say, oh, I just want to find some peace of mind. I have news for you. Peace isn't found. It's felt. And by working and continually working these steps and reaching out to my higher power and helping another drunk, I feel that peace. I get out of self. Oh, I just want to be happy. I think happy is overrated. You talk to 10 people, you get 10 different answers on what happy is. But joy and peace we get. And content. Today I am content. My insides match my outsides. And I know for myself that what I wanted to share, and I went off on a tangent there, about 5 years ago in my sobriety, that through my own attitudes and actions, because I believe that our attitudes and actions determine our destiny, my own attitudes and actions, I refer to it as a black spot in my sobriety. And there again, I did not have that pause because I am not perfect. And I don't believe we're supposed to be perfect or somebody else. And I had that black spot, and it came to a point where I wanted to drink, I wanted to smoke, and I wanted to kill myself from my attitudes and my actions. And when I told my sponsor, he said about, you could seek outside help, and I did. And I remember saying to him, I'm not going to that meeting anymore. He says, you're going. I said, I'm not going to be in a group to that meeting anymore. You're going to be in a group. I says, I'm going to move. He said, hold on to that thought. And I took his direction. And I found out people that supported me and were friends. And I found out others that weren't. But because of taking a direction, and I found out that at these times in our journey and in life, these are the times for me when I'm the most willing to pray, the most honest in my prayers, the most sincere in my prayers. I don't pray when I'm playing nickel-dime poker, coming out of a movie, when I'm going through something. You better believe I'm praying. But there again, I had to start with that gratitude, that attitude of gratitude daily. And there's another series of non-coincidences that happened in that in my life at that point. And I just wanted to bring that out because it is a part of my story. And if you have problems, and our literature says, you could seek outside help. And so I know for myself that when I mentioned to Glenn and talked with my sponsor, who am I? And he said that, everything you are is God. Now, you are not everything that God is. And the example that he gave was that you take a cell from your hand, and everything that is in that cell is you. It is not all of you, but everything in that cell is you. And you are comprised of God. And at times I wonder, is there really a plan? But then how couldn't there be? I mean, butterflies migrate to Mexico, swallows go to Capistrano. Salmon swim upstream when they're spawning. Who gives them that intuitive thought and decision, as it says we should pray for in the 11th step? And because of making those amends and making those amends to that club that I embezzled from, and in the promises it says you'll know a new freedom and a new happiness. And in the beginning it was from the alcohol and the drugs. But now that new freedom and that new happiness is from Ed. And I'm able just to be. And I just want to finish it in saying and I enjoy this page 164. Still, you may say, but I will not have the benefits of contact with you who write this book. We cannot be sure. God will determine that. So you must remember that your real reliance is always upon Him. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditations what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come. If your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right. And great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God and admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past and give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge that road of happy destiny. And may God bless you and keep you until then. My name is Ed Trushin. My home group is Promises in Allentown. My sobriety date is August 22nd, 1996. Thank you for listening and having me.